because with the discovery of the oil, and let's pinpoint that date, the first strike was in February of 68, and the confirmation well came in around the 1st of July, June 18th, 26th, in that area of 1968. And then in the fall of 1969, the state, without authority, sold 412,000 acres of oil rights on the North Slope for $900 million. So everybody in Alaska figured they were going to be instant millionaires. All the merchants overbought, and they oversold on credit, and they overbought on credit, and there was great hardship because of the land freeze. So the oil companies figured that they were going to, in a sense, hoodwink the native leadership. And they proposed to the native leadership and their lawyers that they release their aboriginal rights along the pipeline corridor in return for jobs. Shortly, we're going to have this great big pipeline built and you're going to get jobs out of it. A very illusory contract. And actually, some of the native groups did sign up and did waive their rights to the pipeline. Well, of course, had it been a real contract where the natives got some real rights out of it, it would have been a violation of federal law. Good old Section 25 U.S. Code 177. But it illustrates, too, that there was a difference between some of the native leaders and the feeling of the people. The native people, like Ann Reardon's paper so beautifully illustrates, couldn't release their land. It would be against their moral fiber. But there it was. It was part of the movement. Well, luckily, the Alaska Legal Services put an end to that illusory contract with Atlantic Richfield and the other oil companies. Along with this white man's world and tools in a white man's world was the desire that the native people had inside themselves of being first-class citizens. For decades, the white people of the state considered natives inferior. The BIA pushed the native people around. The school people wouldn't admit children to the white school. You're inferior. So there was a desire inside of the native people that they be first-class citizen, would have a right to sit in the theater in any place he wanted to, or to go to a school that he wanted to go to, or sit on in any place in a church, if you please. They had natives on one side and the whites on the other. And they had these signs in the restaurants, no dogs or natives allowed. The desire to be first-class citizens. Now, this desire to be first-class citizens, to have adequate tools to compete in a white man's world, was the management by the BIA of the IRA. There are about 75 IRAs up here. And the BIA, in the actual organization of the IRAs at the village level, or in the organization or the administration of the IRAs for whatever their business activity was controlled by the BIA at Juneau, and they in turn were controlled by Washington, D.C. For example, we had quite a number of canneries in Southeast, but the BIA ran those canneries even though it was in the name of the village IRA. But unless the villagers signed whatever the Indian office put in front of them, they had the threat of no more money for their canneries in those days and fishing boats. The IRA is a wonderful vehicle, in my judgment. It is the formalization of tribal, the tribe in a white man's kind of language. You got a constitution, much like the Articles of Incorporation. It's something that a bank can understand or a congressman can understand. It is an entity. It is a legal entity that has a structure to it. But as a product of the administration of the IRA and the ability of the BIA to dominate the village IRAs, there was built up inside of the natives up here a rather dislike, in some cases hatred, of the IRA form of entity. For example, in the fall of 1970, late summer and fall of 1970, the North Slope Native Association developed what we call a conceptual outline of what a bill should be. It wasn't the actual drafting of a bill, it was the ideas that were to go into the actual drafting. And one of the provisions we had in this conceptual outline was that the vehicle of the settlement should be in the IRA. I'm sad to report, aside from Don Wright, I'm sad to report that not a single Native leader promoted the IRA concept as a vehicle for the settlement. It fell flat. Along with this desire of first-class citizens is there was this assault through the decades by the white organized white society, as manifested in schools and in our marriage laws. You had to get a license, for example, in marriage laws from a U.S. commissioner. Well, there were, in those days, there were only 40 U.S. commissioners in the whole state. And the reason why the state legislature put these restrictions on marriage is because too many of the natives had married, under common law marriage, minors who had made a fortune. And were they going to divvy up their community assets with what we termed in those days a klooch? You see this manifested so that inside the native, by God, he was going to be a first-class citizen and be like all white men. One of the problems we had in framing the structure of the settlement, I'm not talking about how much land or how much money, but who was going to get it. There's been throughout the state, there was a great belief in the villages. That is to say, if the yield of the settlement goes to a village, then I, a native, would have some authority on how it's going to be spent. One of the problems of distributing the yield of the settlement, land and money, to a village is that it fractures the amount of power that the native settlement would vest in the natives. The politicians did not want a regional concept, because a region might have some financial support, financial power, surely, but with financial support, you have political power. It was not until the summer of 1970, year and a half before settlement, that the North Slope Native Corporation was adopted by the Senate passed version, that the other natives of Alaska realized that if the Eskimos of the North Slope were going to have a regional concept, a regional corporation, that they, because of their amassing of a lot of the land and money in a regional concept, that perhaps they would dominate the rest of the Native movement. And that's when the regional concept bore fruit. But again, trying to have a viable, powerful corporation or whatever the mechanism would be, come out of the settlement, you had to have the regional concept. Now, another great movement that took place was there was going to be a statewide corporation. Well, that was very hurtful to the North Slope Eskimos because in a statewide corporation, they would own 5% of the stock. Western society had moved into the North Slope just in the beginning of the 1960s, and their ability to protect themselves as against the more vigorous natives, that is more vigorous in the sense of Western society, they would be lost, they would be swallowed up. Another concept that was hurtful to the native cause in the statewide corporation was manifested in Chairman Aspinall and Chairman Haley's version in the spring of 1971, just a few months before settlement. He wanted the bulk of the settlement to go to the statewide corporation. And who would appoint the directors of the statewide corporation but the governor of Alaska? So you have no self-determination at all. Very hurtful. Another task we in the Native movement had to combat was the idea of pro bono council. Justice Goldberg and Ramsey Clark, no doubt, are the most well-motivated people in the world. But unless, under the rules of capitalism, unless the client pays the lawyer, if the lawyer is doing it just to be a good citizen, that file is always at the bottom of the heap. The pro bono lawyer does not devote the attention or time or talent of which he is capable to the cause of the client. The pro bono lawyers, the background of Ramsey Clark was, for many years he was an assistant attorney general in charge of natural lands and natural resources, which in turn had charge of the Indian litigation, which in turn meant that when an Indian nation sued the United States in the Court of Claims, it was Ramsey Clark's duty to oppose the merits of that case. He was fighting tooth and nail to protect the treasury of the United States against the natives. And the idea that natives had land rights, according to his heritage of many years as Assistant Attorney General of the United States, was that, of course, natives had no land rights. One of the problems we had was, speaking of these pro bono lawyers, is that one of them had lately graduated as solicitor for the Department of the Interior. Now, eventually, Ed Weinberg got to believe in Indian rights through Don Wright's great leadership. But for 2 years, before he got education, Ed Weinberg didn't believe in land rights. And yet he's general counsel, so to speak, for the Alaska Federation of Natives. There has to be a belief in the integrity of the rights of the client. And the problem of educating the pro bono lawyers was difficult. Now, a word about the drafting of the Settlement Act. Let me throw out a figure. It is a thoughtful figure. I have made a study of it. But I would like to tell the Commission that the lawyer's fees arising out of ANCSA must be at least $50 million. Everybody's suing everything. everybody else. They got boundary disputes. They got internal squabbles. They got enrollment problems. Some dissident gets angry at management. The Seven-I litigation, I don't know how much that cost, but many millions of dollars. Now, who did the drafting of the Settlement Act? As I indicated, by and large, legislation was drafted by two people, chairman of the House Committee and chairman of the Senate Committee. Now, congressmen and senators don't do any drafting personally. They have staff for that. Let me illustrate what happened in November and December of 1971. Now we have a House version and we have a Senate version. They're different. So the two houses of Congress have to get together and iron out their differences. Early on, we must remember that Senator Jackson was running for president. So Aspinall dominated the conference committee, and of course it was a House bill which was used as a markup for the ultimate law that was passed. The House bill, by and large, was written by Louis Sigler. Louis Sigler was a graduate of the Department of the Interior for 25 years, and the Department of the Interior never believed in the Solicitor's Office, never believed, well, not that's pretty strong, but usually they did not believe in Indian land rights. Felix Cohen's an exception, Nathan R. Margold's an exception, but Sigler never believed in Indian land rights. He's the one that drafted Aspinall and Haley's bill, introduced a little bit earlier. So the Native leadership, whether it was the Arctic Slopes lawyers or the AFN's lawyers, all of us tried to work with Sigler. All of us tried to work with Bill of NS, but there was no way. They were doing their own drafting. And primarily Sigler did the drafting. And the mess that settlement has, that Settlement Act has in the internal mechanism of the statute, never mind the yield, the 40 million acres and the $1 billion, just the internal mechanism was a product, and by and large, of Louis Sigler. Race prejudice was a great deal of involved in our settlement, and race prejudice has many manifestations. Now, I'm going to mention limited entry for two reasons. The first is a little harder to demonstrate. But society can, as I say, implement race prejudice in lots of ways. In order to qualify for a limited entry permit so that a man could go out and catch a few fish for cash and catch a few fish for subsistence, depended upon what records you kept. If you fished during the magic years, 1971 principally, and had records to prove of a certain number of landings, you got a free permit. If you couldn't produce those receipts, and by and large, natives don't preserve records for income tax purposes, you didn't get your permit, which meant that you were on the beach. Throughout the whole estate, and including rivers too, there are hundreds and thousands of Alaska Natives who cannot fish commercially. In Bristol Bay and in the Aleutian Islands, the forecast during the magic year was a poor fish run. So the Natives went out and went firefighting. They got good wages for firefighting. They obeyed the estimates of the fish and game people. That was going to be a poor year. Well, if it's going to be a poor year, I got to make some money. So they were firefighting, which in turn meant they didn't get a permit. There's a beautiful report out by the name of, written by the name of Kosloff, K-O-S-L-O-F-F, from La Jolla, California, who made a study of four villages in Bristol Bay. And out of a potential 100 fishermen, there are about four permits. Now, limited entry is also important for the purpose of this inquiry, is because these permits are very valuable. They're transferable. They're alienable. It's like having money. You can go into a store and buy. You can take your permit and get some cash for it. Some of the permits, I don't suppose anybody could get a Chignik permit today. Chignik permits must be worth $400,000, $500,000. The fishermen there make $200,000 a year. Bristol Bay permits are $100,000, $150,000. These permits are being sold. I'm talking about the natives now. The natives who have permits are being sold, and they're being sold, and they're being sold. I take a little village like Angoon. I think it's got two permits now. Hoonah has 10 or 12. And you can go up and down the coast. And Dr. Steve Langdon has done a study on the transfer of permits. A beautiful study. Now, we've got 1991 coming. What's going to happen to the stock? In the permit situation, you only got one permit. But supposing you got four sons and daughters, and daughters, by the way, are operating boats. Who are you going to give it to when you die? Or maybe you're going to sell it for your old age. I guess there's a few natives who get drunk once in a while. So maybe you get drunk and you sell it. It is, in lots of ways, a blueprint of what's going to happen to the stock certificates out of the anchor corporations. Now, again, I want to give my applause to the concept of the Alaska Native Review Commission. I hope that the whole Native community supports it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Paul. Mr. Al Ketzler, could we call on you now?
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here, Mr. Chairman, and I noticed in the papers you sent out, the agenda and procedures, that you're using 68 and 69 as a basis of some of the discussion here. Mm-hmm. I'd like to go back a little further. I became involved in land claims and actively involved in 1962 in Nenana when I was a young man there. I had been chief at a time before, but in the early 1962 there was discussions among the Native Council, the chiefs and the people there that had a number of concerns about what the state was doing, because in the Nenana area there was a lot of land selections that were taking a lot of the traditional use lands, so there would be no way for a native to ever become owner of those lands, and those were what they called the university lands or mental health lands. They had their specific purpose lands, but we were losing the use or the ownership of them. So the chief at the time, Alphonse Domenoff, sent out a letter to a number of the interior villages, inviting them to come to Nenana in February when there was dog races held there in a big celebration. So 10 villages showed up, and we had a couple days of meetings and discussing the problems. And of course, the problem we had then are still here, basically. We may have progressed some on them. But the discussion got around to what could we do about it, and was there a way to maybe do something statewide or region-wide? And we had got back to Tanana Chiefs Conference, which was the meeting of the Tanana area chiefs, which met in Tanana, Alaska, where the rivers come together. They had a celebration they called Nuchilawaya, which when they gathered there, they had their games and so on. So in the last meeting that we knew of that was held by the chiefs was about 1915. So this was 1962. So we decided to, or the group there decided that they would revive the Tanana Chiefs meetings. We would come together and talk about all of our problems and see if we could organize and do something about all the issues that we had discussed, or which was land loss, loss of use of land, employment, education, and all the whole gamut of problems. I was not, like I say, I was not the chief, but I attended all the meetings, and by a consensus of the group, I was going to be the one that was going to organize the Tanana Chiefs meeting in Tanana. And so with the help of another organization, where I got some money from them, and I was able to hire a part-time secretary, and I'm going to do a little commercial here. The Association of American Indian Affairs helped pay for a secretary and some of the expenses that we incurred setting this meeting up. We sent out letters to all of the villages in the interior. In fact, I think I went far afield. I was sending letters way down in the Bethel area. And we organized it. The village of Tanana got into it. They organized Nuchulawaya, which they set up for in conjunction with our meeting. And we put it all together through a lot of letter writing, phone, being on the phone, and so on. And we, in June of 1962, we held our first meeting. And at that meeting, I was elected chairman of it for the first year. And we covered all of the issues, again, hunting and fishing rights. Of course, the big issue back then was the Rampart Dam. Were they gonna, you know, if they were going to build it, what would they do with all the peoples that lived in the area, and, you know, how about land and education, employment, you know, who got the jobs in the villages? And I think probably we still have basically the same problem. And during that time, of course, we didn't have any money, and like I say, I financed most of my activities out of my home and out of my own pocket, the letter writing and so on. And I had my niece was a good secretary, so she helped me out in doing a lot of the letter writing.